It was sarin, but the UN won't say who did it. Today, Monday, September 16th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A UN report confirms the use of sarin gas in last month's chemical attack near Damascus. The report assigns no blame, but concludes that chemical weapons have been used in the Syrian conflict on a large scale. Also today, a budding correspondence between President Obama and Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, has tongues wagging in Washington and Tehran.
This is the first instance that we have of a letter sent and returned relatively immediately in a way that appears to be at least somewhat constructive.
And later, a survivor of the Costa Concordia cruise ship disaster vows to sail again.
Is the last thing I ever do on a ship jumping off and swimming? If you'll excuse me, I'll be damned if that's going to happen, you know? I'm not going to let that define me.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The United Nations says it has confirmed unequivocally and objectively that chemical weapons have been used in Syria. A UN report released today does not assign blame for a chemical attack outside Damascus last month, but Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was blunt. This is a war crime, he said. President Obama has welcomed a deal signed by the U.S. and Russia to eliminate Syria's chemical weapons stockpile, but he said the plan will have to be implemented properly. Here's The World's Matthew Bell with the latest.
UN weapons inspectors visited the site of the August 21st attack east of Damascus. They interviewed more than 50 survivors. They collected soil and munition samples. They analyzed hair, urine, and blood from victims. And the new UN report says it all adds up to clear and convincing evidence that rockets containing the nerve agent sarin were used. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon would not assign blame, but he said what happened on August 21st was a war crime.
It is for others to decide whether to pursue this matter further to determine responsibility. We may all have our own thoughts on this, but I would simply say that this was a grave crime, and those responsible must be brought to justice as soon as possible.
But the Obama administration has already made up its mind. It lays blame squarely at the feet of Syrian government forces. Speaking in Paris today, Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. and Russia have agreed Syria must get rid of its chemical weapons or face serious consequences.
President Obama, and I have repeated his statement, has warned that should diplomacy fail, the military option is still on the table.
France and Britain are thought to be on board with the U.S. to come up with a tough new Security Council resolution on Syria, but the Russians have rejected the idea of threatening military intervention. Meanwhile, Turkey says its warplanes have shot down a Syrian military helicopter.
Suriye'ye ait bir adet Mi-17 helikopteri.
Turkish Deputy Prime Minister Bülent Arınç said the Syrian helicopter violated Turkish airspace. It was warned repeatedly, he said, and then fired on with a missile, causing it to fall on Syrian soil. Turkey's government has become a fierce critic of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. It's given refuge to Syrian rebels and advocated for greater outside military intervention in Syria. Walid Safour is UK-based spokesman with the opposition Syrian National Coalition. He told the BBC today that all the international attention on chemical weapons could be a distraction from the damage that's still being inflicted by the Assad regime.
Syrian regime has been killing the Syrian people by conventional weapons for the last 30 months. Eventually, he used the chemical weapon because of the inaction and the hesitation of the international community. Now curbing and controlling chemical weapons only is not the issue. The issue is the regaining of freedom and equality and removing this dictatorship, this killing regime.
But the American public, at least, is still not persuaded. Polls suggest that most people do not support U.S. military intervention in Syria. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The U.S. and Iran don't see eye to eye on Syria and many other topics, but over the weekend, we found out that President Obama and Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, have exchanged letters. And here I thought nobody writes letters anymore. Suzanne Maloney of the Brookings Institution says the correspondence was probably delivered through diplomatic channels.
Reports in the Iranian press have suggested that it was carried by the Sultan of Oman, who has been an interlocutor between the two countries for many years now. And this tends to be the way that American governments have sent official communications to the Iranian leadership outside the formal channel that exists between the foreign ministries of both countries.
It seems like such an outdated way to communicate. I mean, what is the import of a letter? Why write a letter as opposed to anything else at this point in time?
Well, the U.S. and Iran have a sort of interesting relationship, one that lacks any direct communication mode between the two countries. Iran is the only country in the world in which the United States does not have a formal presence through an embassy or some other official presence in the country. So as a result, we're forced to communicate through third parties. I think what's useful about the letter from the president and why it is that Obama has used this mechanism and that the Iranians apparently have reciprocated is that it is an opportunity to set out in a way that is considered respectful in the Iranian tradition and, in fact, cannot be misinterpreted in the way that signals and overtures tend to be between these two countries.
I mean, why not? I mean, what's embedded in a letter that makes it so kind of definitive?
Well, I don't know that it's definitive, but it's an explicit communication between two individuals and one in which the Iranians can look as opposed to simply point to a speech or a referenced phrase muttered in public, which has often been the way that the two leaderships have communicated with one another. The letter is the most appropriate way for a U.S. leader to reach out to his Iranian counterpart and vice versa. The difficulty and the obstacle that we've had in the past is that there has never been a moment at which time the two leaderships were prepared to engage with one another. We've seen indications in the past that President Obama has communicated directly with Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. We know in the past that Iranian leaders have, in fact, reached out to Washington via letters. Both of these sort of overtures have gone unreciprocated. This is the first instance that we have of a letter sent and returned relatively immediately in a way that appears to be at least somewhat constructive.
So what does that all mean? I mean, are they prepared now to take it deeper? And if so, why now?
I think what we're seeing is just the opening moves in what is going to be inevitably a complicated and prolonged process of testing the other side. And it began really not just with these letters, but with the election of a new Iranian president back in June of this year. The individual who won that election, Hassan Rouhani, appears to have been given a mandate both by the people who came to the ballot, but also by the political establishment who enabled him to run and permitted him to win in an election that is nothing close to free and fair. His mandate is to get Iran out of the box that it's in, the box of sanctions and international isolation that have come over the course of the past 8 years in particular. And the clearest path to doing that is to begin to find some accommodation on the nuclear issue. The only way that can be accomplished is by dealing directly with the United States of America.
I'm also just curious about the details of the letters themselves. I mean, do you know if the one sent to Rouhani was handwritten or typed? What was the tone like? Was it formal, informal?
We don't really know any details. I mean, the Iranian press, of course, tends to leak these things almost immediately. So there have been indications in a number of newspapers, both hardline and reformist, of this kind of communication that came in. And early indications suggested that it was a formal letter that indicated some congratulations on behalf of the victory of Rouhani in the presidential election and urged, as President Obama has done publicly and apparently in private correspondence previously, that Iran sit down seriously to negotiate and deal with the issues and differences it has with the international community. I wouldn't expect anything specific in that form of a letter, although it's also been reported in the Iranian press that the Sultan of Oman may have, in fact, referenced some specific financial sanctions which could be lifted if Iran was prepared to make some real progress and make some concessions on its nuclear program.
Suzanne Maloney, Senior Fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The death of an Afghan policewoman today caught our attention. Sub-Inspector Negara was fatally shot yesterday by gunmen outside her home. She was apparently targeted because of her gender. Negara was the most senior policewoman in Helmand Province. Like many Afghans, she had only one name. She was a mother in her late 30s. And here's her only son, Hamid Jan, describing the last time he saw her alive.
I was going to work on my motorbike, so I asked mom to come with me. But she refused, telling me that a car was coming to pick her up. I was on the road when I received a call informing me that my mother had been shot.
Negara was the second policewoman to be killed in Helmand Province since July. At her funeral today, another female police officer who didn't want to be named said she and her colleagues are not safe.
We have received warnings from the Taliban that they will kill each of us within 3 months. They said that they will kill every single policewoman in Helmand within 3 months.
Candice Rondo is currently working on a book on the conflict in Afghanistan based on her 5 years' experience living and working there as an analyst with the International Crisis Group. Candice, this is turning into a recurring nightmare for Afghan female police. Is the Afghan government doing enough to protect them?
Well, that's clear it's not. And the question is really, can the Afghan government do enough? It does have a lot on its plate. I think the coalition, you know, ISAF in particular, has tried to push its own line in terms of expanding resources for female police officers, for female soldiers, and for politicians in general. But it really also has been fairly soft on this message. And I think that ultimately what it comes down to is a failure of both the Afghan government and the international community in terms of prioritizing security and gender mainstreaming in Afghanistan.
Some Afghan police women have even been threatened by members of their own family. Can you explain why that's happening?
Well, I think, you know, the idea of women joining the workforce in any context, be it Afghan or, you know, American, I mean, historically has shown to be a very controversial question. I mean, it raises questions about the political order, the family structure. It raises questions especially about the economic order. And in Afghanistan, where you've had this big and just gaping gender divide between who works and who doesn't work, obviously the idea of a woman going into the workforce is a big deal. But of course, women joining the police force also means that they're going to be alongside men. And these are some of the cultural norms that you're dealing with in a very particular situation in Afghanistan, where there's a lot of ideas about sort of the honor of a woman being besmirched by simply having contact with men, strange men who are not members of the family. So it's a matter of personal family honor, unfortunately. And this is not really a trend that's really reversed.
So given all the risks, why do women keep volunteering for duty with the security forces in Afghanistan? Maybe you've met one or two who you can tell us what they've told you.
Yeah, I mean, I've met a few female police officers, and obviously they come to it for different reasons. Some come to it because they have no choice. There are plenty of women out there who have been widowed, who have been abandoned, who are no longer considered honorable or economically viable in terms of the family structure, simply because of choices that they've made, very personal choices that they made about who they will associate with. So for younger women who are less susceptible to some of the conservatism that has been present in Afghanistan, joining the police force is a very attractive option. It's a way to make money and to, you know, become independent. But of course, a lot of women also do express a real genuine sense of patriotism, like this is something that they need to do in order to help Afghanistan advance in the world order.
Candice Rondo lived and worked in Kabul for 5 years as an analyst with the International Crisis Group. Candice, thanks for your thoughts on this.
Thank you.
Still ahead on The World, a toga party with lattes and mango juice. We're talking a Muslim fraternity here, later on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Our next story is about a game of cat and mouse that plays out every night along the banks of the Rio Grande. On one side, the U.S. Border Patrol. On the other, migrants who cross the river into the U.S. illegally. Over the past 2 years, the number of migrants crossing at this part of the border has doubled, and so have migrant deaths. Monica Ortiz Uribe, with the public radio collaboration Fronteras, reports on the challenges of patrolling the South Texas border.
Night falls in the Rio Grande Valley outside Mission, Texas. The river glistens under a full moon, deceivingly peaceful. Suddenly, through a pair of night vision goggles, a Border Patrol agent spots movement. He picks up his radio.
Hey, 402, can you tell us on the raft?
A mother and her two infant boys are floating across on a raft. They'll make it onto U.S. soil, but their taste of success is brief. They're apprehended and put in the back seat of a Border Patrol Suburban. The family is from Guatemala, on their way to reunite with the woman's husband in the States. Now their fate will be a detention center and likely deportation. While apprehensions across the southern border are declining, South Texas is the one spot where the numbers are rising again. So far this year, the Border Patrol has detained nearly 200,000 people in this part of Texas. Mark Foster is a Border Patrol supervisor.
We could apprehend anywhere between 100 and 200 a shift.
In response, the Border Patrol is shifting resources and 600 more agents to South Texas. But the terrain out here doesn't help. The Rio Grande River swerves and curls downstream like a string of yarn. Access is limited by gravel pits, cliffs, and delicate wildlife refuges. There's also private homes and farmland where locals can make a pretty profit cooperating with smugglers. Daniel Perez is a newly minted Border Patrol agent.
It's down here, you got the river, and then they come into this jungle gym of a brush we got, and hiding spaces everywhere.
Historically, heavier enforcement has pushed immigrants out of urban centers to the deadly Arizona desert, and now rural Texas, which has its own dangers. Metal poles clank onto the back of Eddie Canales' pickup. He's 70 miles north of the border in Brooks County, Texas. These poles will be topped with a giant blue flag.
Blue means water.
Canales works with a network of human rights groups. The blue flag is for a water station he's fixing to put in a nearby ranch that's frequently traversed by immigrants. 3 years ago, Brooks County recovered the bodies of 20 dead immigrants. Last year, the number of dead shot up to 129.
We save lives out here every week.
Lavosier Durham manages 1,300 acres on El Tule Ranch, west of the county seat of Falfurrias. It's rough country out here. Oppressive heat, thorny thickets, insects, and snakes.
You know, people have given up, and they're crawling to my house and knocking on my door, and please give me water, and please give me food.
The immigrants come through Durham's land to avoid the Border Patrol checkpoint south of town on U.S. Highway 281. In the last two decades, Durham has found his share of bodies. A telltale sign, he says, is a circle of buzzards.
Actually, you're pretty lucky when you find a dead one because of the coyotes and the vultures and the javelinas. They eat them up.
The majority of immigrants crossing the border now are from Central American countries like Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. They say violence back home makes life impossible, so they flee.
My name is Benny Martinez. I'm the chief deputy for the county of Brooks.
Martinez says last year, Brooks County spent nearly $200,000 burying the unidentified remains of border crossers in the local cemetery. There are also smugglers who operate here, he says. Recently, sheriff deputies stopped a U-Haul trailer stuffed with 70 migrants.
They're on U.S. soil, and this is where we need to step up and start doing something more proactive to where we can avoid this death out here.
This year, the body count is already at 70. At this pace, Martinez believes Brooks County could end up with more dead than last year. For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe, reporting from the South Texas border.
As part of our Global Nation coverage of immigration, we've been trying to bring you a variety of voices, from border crossing agents, as you just heard, to undocumented immigrants. Today we hear from a conservative state lawmaker in Idaho who's been actively fighting for tighter controls on immigration. The World's Jason Margolis has this profile.
Republican Mike Jorgensen served in the Idaho State Senate from 2004 to 2010. I asked him, what's the right solution for the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States?
To go back to Mexico, to file an application, to go through the process, to get into a work program. And if we have a work program that isn't adequate and we need the workers, and that's what everybody's saying, we need the workers, then it's incumbent upon ourselves to come up with a new workers' program.
I met Jorgensen at his home in Hayden Lake, a community of 574 people in northern Idaho, not far from the Washington state border. Jorgensen grabbed headlines in 2010 campaigning for re-election. He vowed to propose an Arizona-style law which toughened state laws against immigrants living in the United States illegally. Jorgensen lost to his primary challenger. Jorgensen seems okay with that, but he's not okay with the labels some attach to his hardline stance.
I'm not a racist. I'm not motivated by racism. I'm motivated by the physical impact that it has on our government.
The number of Latinos in Idaho has increased dramatically over the past 15 years. Jorgensen says the ones here illegally drain state coffers.
For special education, to bring people who don't speak English up to speed so they can be taught, to pay their books, to pay their meals. Many of the hospitals take care of illegal aliens on a free basis. We're required to.
All told, Jorgensen figured that undocumented immigrants were costing the state $200 million a year. Greg Hill, a public policy expert at Boise State University, says there's no strong evidence to support this claim. He says, sure, undocumented immigrants can use taxpayer-funded services, but it's not that easy for them to do.
It's very hard for an undocumented woman to take her child, even if he was born in the United States, to receive social services. I mean, to argue that undocumented workers are shutting down emergency rooms, you know, it's an interesting question. They may be, but do we know they are is a different question.
Hill adds that undocumented workers who use phony Social Security numbers, as many do, are paying taxes they'll never recoup. Mike Jorgensen dismisses this as a, quote, meaningless argument. He says it doesn't offset what illegal aliens cost the state overall, and he says that cost isn't just monetary.
Idaho never used to have illegal employees. What we had was we had a lot of high school students who milked cows and, you know, did the fruit picking and things like that.
I countered that most every farmer I spoke with in Idaho and throughout the nation say they have to rely on immigrant workers because Americans don't want these jobs. It's hard work milking a cow or picking crops. Jorgensen countered back that Idaho high schoolers don't even have the opportunity to get those jobs anymore. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Hayden Lake, Idaho.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the founder of America's first all-Muslim fraternity tries to navigate two worlds.
To the Muslims, we're not doing Muslim things, you know, we're not going to the mosque and reading Quran. And to the frat boys, we're not really frat, you know, we don't party and we don't get drunk and run around naked, you know, things like that.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. For the past year and a half, the cruise ship Costa Concordia has sat on its side exactly where it ran aground in January 2012, right off the coast of Italy's Giglio Island. 32 people died in the ensuing chaos, and the ship's captain is on trial for manslaughter. Today, engineers finally began to lift the crippled ship off the rocky seabed. They'll eventually right the vessel and tow it to the scrap heap. Ian Fraser survived the disaster by swimming to shore. He was an entertainer aboard the Concordia the night of the accident.
I wasn't doing a show that night. I was off. I was free. And I was in my cabin just watching TV. And it was a normal evening, nothing to worry about. But suddenly there was this tremendous lean as the ship turned sharply to starboard to the right, which threw everything off the bed, everything off the shelves, and followed by a tremendous vibration and juddering, which in all the years I've been doing ships, I've never felt or experienced before. So I knew something was seriously wrong. When you're on board a ship, there's a constant hum of the engines, which you get used to, a constant rumble in the background. That had gone. And that's when you know, well, the engines have stopped, so something has gone wrong. And after that, it was just a case of finding out what had happened and getting to our muster stations and starting the abandoned ship.
Right. And how tough was that for you to get off the boat?
Funny, the impact didn't really dawn on me until the point came where I had to get off the ship. It's weird. You still think it's going to be a normal day. We had rehearsals on a show the following day, and while I'm standing on deck and the ship is slowly listing more and more, I'm still thinking, you know, keep your voice nice and warm because you'll be singing tomorrow night. It was only when an officer sort of shouted to us from a deck above, look, you need to get off, that I thought, you know, crikey, we are actually leaving the ship. And on getting up onto deck four and looking through the ship, you could see the waves lapping onto deck four, when really that should have been about 50 feet above seawater. And that's when it hit you, crikey, we are in real trouble now. We need to get off. And that's when your stomach turns. That's when you think, right, we need to get off the ship.
And when you got off and started swimming to shore, were you trying to get other people to come with you? Or was pretty much, I'm going to do this on my own because I don't want to endanger anybody else?
Well, it came to the point where we were on the ship. We were surrounded by about 50 passengers and about half a dozen crew members, four of which were part of my show team. A passenger was standing by some gates which open up, and he said, what do I do? And everyone in their various languages said, jump. So it was a case of jumping, and we jumped one after the other. And swam. Luckily, we all had life jackets on, and we swam to shore. It was an incredible moment. So looking back at the ship leaning over you, the funnel towering over you to my left-hand side. When I got to the shore and turned round, the point of the deck that we'd all jumped from was underwater. That had gone. It was that quick when it actually happened.
Now that the ship's being raised, what are your thoughts when you see the footage of the Costa Concordia being pulled up now?
It's so sad to see it that way. And when you see the ship being raised and the discoloration on the hull there, you just think, oh, this poor ship. As I say, I'll put what happened to the passengers to one side. That really does go without saying, of course. But you look at the ship and the physical damage to that beautiful vessel, and you think, what a shame. What a waste. Completely pointless, completely needless. Lives ruined. A beautiful ship is now going to be destroyed and broken up, and all for nothing. Tragedy. It really is. The more you think about it, the more angry you get, really.
Ian, how were you affected afterwards by the tragedy? I mean, have you been back on a ship?
No, I haven't. It wasn't through choice. It's just the way that my life has taken that direction. I would go back. But it's been a tough day today. It has. It surprised me how emotional I got looking at the pictures and talking about it to people. It's strange. It's quite raw, still raw. And that surprised me, I must be honest.
Are you thinking twice about working again on ships?
Well, I don't want it to define me. I don't want that to spoil a huge part of my life. Ship life is phenomenal. I mean, traveling around the world and getting paid to do it, you're kidding. You know, it's an unbelievable life. You know, is the last thing I ever do on a ship jumping off and swimming? Is that going to be my memory from 20 years of ships? So I'll be damned if that's going to happen. You know, I'm not going to let that define me. So I want to go back. I want to get back on board. But to answer your question, who knows? That first night when I'm in a cabin and the door shuts, I'd like to think I'll be okay. But I think it's going to take a short while to be comfortable on board a ship again.
Ian Fraser, a singer and performer on board ships. He was on board the Costa Concordia the night it ran aground. Ian, thanks very much for speaking with us and recalling some of these memories of that terrible night. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Marco. No problem.
This summer, the International Labour Organization lifted all restrictions on trade and investment in Myanmar. That's one of the rewards Myanmar, or Burma, is reaping in exchange for opening the door to democracy. The government says foreign investment in the country is now five times greater than it was last year. That means more jobs, too. And as the demand for labor increases, Burmese workers are beginning to organize for better working conditions. Nina Patak has a story of one labor activist in Yangon.
Choo Choo Win sits on the floor of her kitchen, eating a bowl of watery rice porridge. It's all she can eat these days because of stomach problems. Problems that might have something to do with her work as a labor organizer. Last May, the Ministry of Labor polled factories about working conditions. Choo Choo Win was collecting the surveys at Esquire Shoe Factory, where she works.
The survey asks 39 main points, like what is the daily rate with or without overtime? Are the bathrooms clean? Do workers have the freedom to form a union? Is there any repression by the factory to the workers?
She took the completed surveys from her factory to the Ministry of Labor. And when she got back, her boss called her into the office and fired her. According to Chu Chu Win, he said it was because she left work without permission. But Chu Chu Win is also a union leader, actively involved in labor organizing. The boss fired four other union leaders at the same time, even though they hadn't left the office. The women, all in their 20s, were not alone in organizing around labor rights. All over the country, workers have staged demonstrations like this one, complete with protest signs and call-and-response chants. Shockingly, workers have been protesting in support of the government. 2 years ago, legislators passed the Labor Organization Law, which legalizes labor unions for the first time since 1962, when a military coup left many Burmese citizens without basic democratic rights. Chu Chu Win and the other organizers formed their union in the summer of 2012. They had been attending labor rights workshops at a sparsely furnished office, commonly known as the reading room.
We know a little bit about the law, so we know about our rights. If we tell other people will ask for their rights.
In May this year, 144 workers at her factory went on strike in support of the five women who were fired. The strike lasted about 2 weeks. The strikers demanded the five women get their jobs back. They also wanted the right to organize without persecution. They wanted higher wages and more respect from their boss. With the help of an arbitration council, all of the workers were hired back in early June. The factory manager, Quan Bok Song, says the whole thing was just a misunderstanding, and that the workers really don't understand labor law. And he says the employees who claim he violates labor law and works them too hard are just plain wrong.
So what I want from them is different what they want from me. So only 10 hours working. It's not hard work. Yeah, look at Bangladesh or Cambodia, even China. If you ask them, please work on Sunday, they would be happy.
Chu Chu Win and the other organizers were happy to get their jobs back. But Ross Wilson says it's rarely that easy. Wilson works at the International Labor Organization's office in Myanmar. He says it's great that the new law has been passed, but to some extent, its shortcomings have inspired the recent wave of protests. He says protection against dismissal and discrimination are still weak.
There are no effective penalties against employers who fail to comply with reinstatement orders from the arbitration bodies and the Arbitration Council. It's frustrating the members of the Arbitration Council. It's incredibly frustrating for the workers because they have no alternative.
In the meantime, Chu Chu Win is still advocating for workers' rights. She's worried about losing her job because of her union work, but not worried enough to stop organizing. For The World, I'm Nina Patuk, Yangon, Myanmar.
Nina's report came from a partnership between Global Post and the Open Hands Initiative, focusing on the stories of a changing Myanmar. And even though a lot is changing there, ancient traditions remain. All over Yangon, there are shrines, big and small, devoted to the country's Buddhist heritage and continued presence in modern life. You can see those shrines in a great slideshow by reporter Bruce Wallace at theworld.org. Here's another story about change. Boston, where this show is based, is one big college town. And with college back in session, I've been noticing the Greek letters again. I'm talking about the alphas and omegas of frat houses, not to mention their hijinks. Not all of them, but some. That's the animal house stereotype. At the University of Texas at Dallas, though, a frat called Alpha Lambda Mu is breaking Greek system stereotypes. And that's because it is, by all accounts, the first all-Muslim fraternity in the United States. Ali Mahmoud is the frat's founder and president. He's a junior majoring in biology and sociology. I asked him if it's hard to reconcile life as both a Muslim and a frat brother.
There's a few stereotypes we have about fraternities. A lot of people think that fraternities are just these white
elitist organizations that started up in the 19th century. But in reality, while there are a lot of, you know, fraternities that did come up and that do have a lot of partying, things like that, that go on, there are a lot of cultural fraternities and service fraternities. You know, like there was a black fraternity that came up in the 20th century, a Jewish fraternity that came up in the 20th century. But we do have to find a middle path. To the Muslims, we're not doing Muslim things. You know, we're not going to the mosque and reading Quran, and we're not, you know, we're praying together, but we're not spending all our time doing ritualistic things. And to the frat boys, we're not really frat. You know, we don't party and we don't get drunk and we don't run around naked, you know, slapping each other and things like that.
And you are doing service oriented things. Tell us about some of the things that you're actually doing locally.
A few of the guys, you know, randomly went to West Texas after the explosion and delivered, you know, pillows and
at the fertilizer plant explosion.
Right, yeah. At the fertilizer plant explosion in West Texas when that happened. Some other guys went up to Moore, Oklahoma after the tornadoes and helped clean up.
Ali, your parents are Egyptian, and I'd guess that many of your frat brothers have kind of similar backgrounds. When you have the choice between doing local charity work and helping overseas, say sending some money to, you know, the refugee camps where Syrians are fleeing to, what's that choice like? Do you have a discussion? Is it a tough discussion?
It's not really a tough discussion at all. We usually try to help out at home as much as possible because that's what's within our reach. I mean, if we have people in our backyard that are starving, I think it's a higher priority for us to help them.
I know, you know, life has been especially tough for Muslims since 9/11. And you've said before that the backlash, some of the backlash has prompted you to be more defensive of your faith. Did founding a Muslim frat also seem like a good way to push back against negative stereotypes of Islam that you've seen since 9/11?
For a lot of, I mean, I was in second grade when 9/11 happened, and for a lot of my life, I've kind of had to tell people what Islam isn't. I've had to tell them, you know, we're not terrorists, we're not misogynistic, we don't hate our women, we don't oppress people, and things like that for my entire life. And getting this opportunity with the fraternity and getting this attention has kind of given us all the opportunity to tell people, hey, you know, this is what Islam is about. This is what we do. We like to help our communities, but we're also college kids. You know, we like to mess around.
I gather the idea of a Muslim frat is spreading. A number of other universities are interested in starting their own chapters, including Cornell in New York. But there's been some backlash as well. Do you know what's going on there?
So, like I said, because we're traveling this weird path, we've just been getting fire from everybody. We've gotten fire from the Islamophobe saying that we're a sleeper cell. We've gotten fire from the super progressive Muslim saying that we're a white elitist or that we're rooted in a white elitist organization that's trying to take control of Islam and put on misogynistic ideals again. But we're just Muslim college kids just trying to have fun and get together without, you know, breaking the rules of our religion. I don't understand these people, bro. Like we're just trying to have fun, dude. Like we're just trying to have fun. We're trying to help people and trying to just live as college students while being able to identify ourselves as Muslim, you know. So it's really, sometimes it's just about being human.
Can I just say Islam has some great robes, and I think you guys at Alpha Lambda Mu could really improve the toga party.
You're right. Actually, it's funny. Some of the guys have joked around. There's when people go onto the Hajj, the pilgrimage, they have to wear these towels that kind of look like togas. So you never know. It's called an ihram. So you never know. We might shave our heads and pull an ihram party instead of a toga party. You never know.
We'll definitely see how things progress. Ali Mahmoud, founder and president of Alpha Lambda Mu, an all-Muslim fraternity at the University of Texas, Dallas. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And if you don't mind, I'd like to give a shout out to my brothers who specially requested it. All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Shahir and Mo World, Mo Bush, Mo Kush, all you guys out there. Thank you guys so much for listening in. I love you guys very much. And I think this is going to be a fun journey.
Yeah, hope so. Batter up for today's GeoQuiz now. Baseball fans in Japan have a new home run king. He's Vladimir Balantin, who hit his 56th and 57th home runs of the season yesterday. That's a new record for the Japanese league. The 29-year-old Balantin currently plays for the Tokyo Yakult Swallows. He used to play here in the U.S. for the Seattle Mariners and Cincinnati Reds, but here's what we want to know. Where is he from? Here are your clues. He's a native of an island in the Caribbean, just north of Venezuela, and Balantin represented the Netherlands in the World Baseball Classic. That clue should help. We're back in just a bit with the answer and more on Japan's new home run king, Vladimir Balantin. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. So Vladimir Balantin is the new home run king in Japan. He hails from the Caribbean island of Curacao, which, by the way, is the answer to our GeoQuiz today. Balantin broke the Japanese league's record for most home runs in a season, hitting his 56th and 57th yesterday for the Tokyo Yakult Swallows. The previous record was 55, set in 1964 by Japanese baseball icon Sadaharu Oh. Ken Belson writes on the business of sports for the New York Times and covered baseball in Japan for more than a decade. So a foreigner has dethroned the homegrown legend, home run king. How's this going down among the Japanese, Ken?
Well, very little fanfare. Over the years, other foreigners have challenged the record and for various reasons have gotten on the threshold of breaking Sadaharu Oh's record, but never passed it. And this actually is being championed, as it should be, as a real achievement.
And so why the little fanfare? Is it because he's a foreigner?
Well, because I think Japanese have come around to the idea that it really doesn't matter who he is, whether he's Japanese or not. And, you know, it's always worth reminding that 99% of the country is Japanese. So it's a country that looks at itself as, I wouldn't say in xenophobic terms, but clearly when a foreigner does something, it's very different. And that was the case for many years. Now I think enough Japanese, especially younger Japanese, have been overseas, have seen Japanese succeed in American baseball, and ask the question, why not a foreigner breaking a record here in Japan?
And Balantin, did he have any difficulties adjusting when he first got to Japan?
You know, he came up through the Seattle and Cincinnati teams, didn't really take hold, and as you're seeing increasingly, decided to go overseas to make his name. The Japanese teams, who only are allowed to carry a handful of foreigners on their roster, would tend to go for big-name players who were perhaps at the ends of their careers. And most of these guys were, in the end, disappointments because they would get to Japan. It was too much of an adjustment, and most of them kind of washed out. And then about 10, 12 years ago, the Japanese clubs decided, you know what, let's look for undervalued talent. Let's look for a very talented Latin American player who maybe didn't take hold, but maybe worth a lot more, maybe more productive for the amount of money they pay.
Tell me about that rule limiting the number of foreigners on the teams in Japan.
Oh, it's been in place since the foreigners were playing in Japan, and I believe they've added one more to the roster. I believe it's now four instead of three, and at one time it was only two. So the Japanese clubs were rather concerned that if it was open, that there would be too many foreigners and it would shut out Japanese players. Hmm. In reality, years ago, there weren't enough players that were interested in going to Japan. It was either a last-ditch stop at the end of your career, or it was for a player who maybe never was going to make the major leagues. Now you're finding enough good talent somewhere in the middle that realize, you know what, I can be a big fish in a small pond.
We have been reading a lot about these changes with the rules going on with the Nippon Professional Baseball, some attempts to make the game more exciting. Were there any changes you think that helped Balantin achieve this record?
Perhaps unintentionally, yes. To bring Japan in line with the World Baseball Classic, 3 years ago they changed the ball to make it a little bouncier, and suddenly home runs were up about 40%. But I don't think he hit 57 by accident. He's just having one of those years.
Mm. Ken Belson with the New York Times, who's been telling us about Vladimir Balantin, who has just become the new home run king in Japan. Vladimir is from Curacao, by the way, the answer to our GeoQuiz. Ken, great to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Some communities in Mexico are reeling from the flooding and evacuations caused by two major storms that hit the country's Atlantic and Pacific coasts almost simultaneously. That's forced some communities to cancel their Independence Day festivities today. But for many Mexicans, this remains a day to celebrate their cultural identity. Reporter Beto Arcos has a profile of one Mexico City band that's taking Mexican roots music to a new level.
After more than a decade of touring and releasing a couple of albums of traditional music, the Mexican roots ensemble Chejere has found their own sound. Their new record is Ojos de Luna. The opening track, Sobre la Marea, or Over the Tide, builds from a soft ballad to an upbeat, dance-oriented composition. Sobre la marea, que viene y que va, se pierden las luces. Sobre la marea que viene y que va. This song is a perfect example of the band's rich palette of musical colors. Founder and musical director Alonso Borja says the record took a year to complete, though most of the songs were written and arranged a while back.
Este disco es 100% original, que era una de las metas, de los objetivos del proyecto de Chejere.
Borja says one of their early goals was to record a completely original album. But this meant that they had to open up to a wide array of sounds. That's what makes it difficult to define what kind of music they play, he says. It's a mosaic that reflects the group's identity, not just as Mexicans, but as Latinos in general. This rich and colorful mosaic is evident in the song Cocuyo, which means firefly. Borja says one night he went out walking in the countryside in southern Veracruz, and he saw fireflies. He says he was so touched by their beauty that it inspired him to come up with these verses.
Cocuyo de madrugada, dame un poco de luz, ¿no?
Firefly of dawn, give me a little light so I can find the roads that can take me to Veracruz.
Cocuyo de madrugada, dame un poco de tu luz para encontrar el camino que va para Veracruz.
Borja says the band wanted to demonstrate the rich improvisational side of traditional music, as in this piece called Caleidoscopio, or Kaleidoscope. Borja says when musicians talk about improvisation, the immediate reference is always jazz. But if you don't have that language, traditional music also has a lot of improvisation. It's a very explosive and spontaneous art form. With the current situation of violence in Mexico, Alonso Borja wrote a song specifically addressing it. The song is called Pa que se acabe la pena, or So That the Pain Ends. Borja says the band is committed to making music that helps people cope with the climate of despair at all levels. What's most needed right now are expressions of love toward people, to cherish life. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos.
Vengo a curarme, vengo a curarme, vengo a curar la pena.
That's it for our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.